It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A state police fire marshal says he may never be able to determine what caused a fire that destroyed the headquarters buildings at the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville. The investigation has found no signs of arson or foul play in the October 3rd fire. An initial inventory indicated the losses included a flag that flew over the U.S. Capitol on September 11, 2001, the day four planes were hijacked by terrorists. The memorial and visitor center under construction about 2 miles away were not damaged. The story of what happened on Flight 93 and the courage displayed by the passengers on that flight have been a source of unending pride for Americans who see the event as one of the inspiring stories of 9/11. It's a story that is chronicled in a new book called Flight 93, The Story, the Aftermath, and the Legacy of American Courage on 9/11. The author is former Post-Gazette writer Tom McMillan, who for the past 18 years has been vice president of communications for the Pittsburgh Penguins. He joins us now in Studio A. Tom McMillan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
All pleasure.
First of all, you are a volunteer at the Flight 93 National Memorial. What is your reaction to this latest news?
With the fire?
Yeah.
It was tragic. Thankfully, no one was hurt. And it could have been a lot worse. It didn't affect the memorial. It never closed. Most of their items, 90% of their items, are in Somerset and protected. They did lose some. So it's tragic. I think it was mentally very difficult for the people out there to see smoke rising above that area again. But I think all things considered, they're going to be able to move forward. Again, the memorial was never closed because this is about 2 miles away. And the construction of the new visitor center and learning center, which I was concerned about as well, was not affected at all. So it's very unfortunate to lose some of those items. But in the big picture, it really could have been a lot worse.
The story of Flight 93 has been told in a variety of ways, including a theatrical feature film. So when you sat down to write this book, what approach were you looking to take that might set your story apart from the others?
Well, the thing that struck me, Paul, was having gone out there probably 20 times in the first 10 years to visit the various temporary memorials, I'm a history buff. I wanted to find more information. I wanted to read more. And it frustrated me that there was a lot of pieces of the story out there. There was only one book written, and it was written within a year after the crash. So not much. The writer did a very good job, but not much was known then. I just thought that after 10 years, there was a need, perhaps, hopefully, to put it together beginning to end. I start with the plot being proposed to Osama bin Laden in 1996 and take it through the 10-year anniversary when they opened the memorial. The flight is actually – the two chapters on the flight are actually in the middle of the book. So I just thought the story was out there in so many different pieces. It needed to be put together and put into a narrative, and that's what I tried to do. The difference obviously from the movie is that that's just the flight. It begins with the takeoff and ends with the crash. So I just thought there was so much more to the story, both beginning and after the fact.
But a big part of your book is trying to give people a glimpse, and we'll never know for sure exactly how everything happened
right
on the flight before it was forced down by the passengers. But what you try to do is really give people a glimpse of in those middle chapters, of what happened during the flight. How did you go about trying to piece that together?
There are some amazing pieces of information that were out there that I think I was the first one to try to put them all together. I just haven't seen it done before. There was a trial, a terrorist trial in 2006 of Zacharias Massawi, who had been arrested in Minneapolis a month before 9/11. And a lot of information came out during that trial.
And he was the guy that was supposed to be involved in it.
He was once rumored to be the 20th hijacker.
Right.
He wasn't, but he certainly was sent over, whether he was going to be a replacement if somebody dropped out or a second wave, which is what they've said. He was involved in some peripheral way, certainly in the plot. A lot of that information came out in that 2006 trial. It's public. It's online, but most people don't know it's there. So the NTSB did an animation of the flight path of Flight 93. I was able to get that. In the trial, they came out with a very detailed transcript of the cockpit voice recorder. Now, only the families and that jury have actually heard the tape, but there's a very detailed transcript, and the FBI did a report of the phone calls and where they came from and how long they were. So putting – I had stuff all over my office on the floor trying to piece it all together sequentially. And some of the things happened at the same time, so you can't do it totally. But I think it's probably as close as you can get. Obviously, as a writer, you have to draw some conclusions a little bit. But there's no more information on that that's going to come out. No, there's nobody who knows anything. So I think that information is what it is. And if it just inspires people to look at it, I will have done my job.
I remember when the movie came out, and I have, like a lot of people, avoided it because it was maybe just too soon after the event, or because you really are watching something like that forces you to relive it. For you as a writer writing this book, and you talked about all these documents that you had on the floor, and you're trying to piece together what was happening on board that plane, and that is as frightening as everything else is, just the idea that these people had all this time enough to make an actual decision and do something. What was it like for you to delve into that and, in a sense, relive it in your own way?
It was incredibly emotional. There were a couple of times, I think most writers will tell you this, during the project that I wanted to take my laptop down and throw it into the Ohio because I thought I can't do this. And some of that was the weight of history, because I started to think, who am I to try to put this together? What if I make an error or something? And then what motivated me when I get back online would be, well, no one else has tried to do it. So it was very emotional. You feel sometimes like you're there. You feel like I read where Doris Kearns Goodwin was writing about in the great book on Lincoln's cabinet. She said she felt she went to bed with these people and woke up with them. And sometimes you do feel that with the project. You become immersed in it. It would have been hard for me to write a book, though, that I wasn't – especially that was out of my job and comfort zone, that wasn't a labor of love.
Right, working in sports day to day is a little different than delving into something that's life and death.
Yes. It was quite the diversion. But it was an opportunity, personal opportunity to do that. But you're right. It does become emotional. It was emotional talking. I talked to two of the ladies who got calls from the plane. And just even though I knew that, just to hear one said, well, I was on the phone with him for 20 minutes from the plane. And it almost just that statement took my breath away, even though I knew it was true, just to imagine that, that perspective.
And how did you decide who to contact to help you tell this story?
I think every writer, you try the best you can. I did. The goal people would ask me, are you talking to all 40 families? And the goal was not – because the first book, Among the Heroes, written in 2002, because not much information was available, that's what the writer did. So I didn't want to rewrite his book. Most of the family members that I talked to were ones who have been involved since. Because as you can imagine, like any of us, some are still very much involved. Some go out to Shanksville every few years. Some have totally moved on. We all handle grief differently, particularly the ones who were involved, because I thought the after story was really important. But the one thing that really sparked this idea was the memorial staff out there has done hundreds of oral histories, which, again, are public but no one knows about. And when I said to them, I said, you've done all this work. Somebody has to mine this and look through. And obviously you can't read all of them. You have to be selective. But I tried to do enough of a cross-section with FBI investigators and first responders and mixing that with real interviews to try to get enough of the story. You could, as we've talked, you could research forever. At some point you have to write. Could there be another book? I think absolutely. But I'm content with what I did.
We're talking with Tom McMillan. He's the author of Flight 93, The Story, The Aftermath, and The Legacy of American Courage on 9/11. I want to go back to where you're talking with one of the survivors in one of the families and the 20-minute conversation. We, over the years in the telling of the story, we've only heard snippets of the conversations. Yeah. So – over the course of – first of all, who was the person you talked to?
It was Liz Glick. Her husband was Jeremy Glick, who was certainly one of the guys who was involved in the fighting. He was a black belt in judo. He was 6'1", 220. He was a guy you would not have wanted to encounter in a situation like that.
Or a guy that you'd want to have on your side if you
– You'd certainly want a guy like him on your side. And he called and the line stayed open for 20 minutes and they talked back and forth. And again, some of these calls – there were
– So over the course of 20 minutes, I'm trying to imagine what was being discussed and what that must have been like.
It was kind of a little back and forth. First of all, it was just – I think fear and bewilderment as to what is going on and describing what was happening, and then hearing back from her about the World Trade Center. Because again, that's how – the people on the plane called to tell loved ones, which is how we know part of the story. But the unintended consequence was that they got information. Flight 93 took off late. And the hijackers of that hijacking crew took the longest to take over the plane. I don't think the passengers and crew on the first three planes were any less brave. They just didn't have any time. These guys didn't have much time, but they had some, and they got that information and that the World Trade Center had been hit. And even then, they're still bewildered. You can tell they're – what do you do? It's out of the realm of anything you can imagine. And then when she was one of the ones who saw the coverage of the Pentagon. When they heard the Pentagon was hit, you could almost sense from the various conversations that's the moment that galvanized them. Then they absolutely knew that they were going somewhere. It was going to be a horrific death, that they had to do something. And he was one of the ones who said – you know, we hear – the famous story is Todd Beamer saying, "Let's roll." Well, other guys had some other dramatic statements. Jeremy Glick said, "I'm going to put the phone down and leave it here. I'll be right back." You know, they were trying to take – you know, one of the myths that came out was they were trying to down the plane. They were trying to save the plane. There was a small engine pilot on board. They thought they could save their lives.
And I think one of the things that's amazing about this is that, you know, the idea that you are getting on a plane that day with something completely different in mind. Maybe you're on a business trip. Maybe mm-hmm. you're flying somewhere to meet a loved one or go on a vacation, whatever it is, and of course the whole day ends up far differently and ends up being your last day on Earth. And it's a story that is terrifying and yet mesmerizing at the same time, which I think is some of what your book captures. You were provided access to information previously unavailable. Are there some other things that you came across that you think are going to be particularly striking to people
in
this book?
To me, it's not that there's a smoking gun. It's the totality of it all. It's piecing it all together to try to make sense. I personally was interested in the part about how the hijackers did this, how they got to America, how they lived here, what they did. It's infuriating to see how open and brazen they were. One in San Diego was listed in the phone book. In the 2001 San Diego phone book, they were very open, and part of that is an amazing part of the story. And while I knew that from a family perspective, they might think there's too much in the hijackers, but I think if you tell the story, you have to tell that part as well, to how these guys who were human beings still were somehow radicalized to the point that they could do this to other human beings. And then on the flip side, the Somerset County Coroner, Wally Miller, and those small town firemen and residents just dealing with all this. This wasn't New York City. It wasn't Washington, D.C. I was fascinated about how this story was different because it was in small town America. And the coroner in charge was a guy who had a funeral home on Taman Avenue in Somerset. And all of a sudden, this national tragedy happens on his land, and they have to figure out how to handle it. And to me, they're in their own way heroic for and the families know that it was different because of that. There were fewer of them on this flight, and there were no people in buildings who were killed. So these were 40 deaths. Nonetheless, they know it was very different because of the personal touch of the small town coroner and those residents.
And it's America looks very different today for a variety of reasons. But when you talk about the terrorists who came here to do what they did, part of what allowed them to do it, of course, were incredible intelligence failures on the ground. Part of what you do in telling this story is to look at that.
Yeah, and it's. It is infuriating, and yet I try to look back, sit back as a citizen and think, you know how much we complain now about everything we have to do at the airport, take our shoes off and we can't take toothpaste on. Imagine if they had tried to impose those things before 9/11, how we as citizens would have reacted. I think basically what it comes down to, there were multiple intelligence failures. I think nobody believed it could happen. I saw a TV interview with one of the investigators who used to be on the FBI, and he said, Osama bin Laden's coming after you. Yeah, you and what army? I really think there was that feeling that this was not a threat, that things could not happen. There may have been some people in security apparatus who imagined in their worst dreams somebody hijacking a plane and flying in, into a building, but nobody, certainly nobody getting on the plane thought of that. Nobody, there were no warnings out for that. So there were some reports sent that summer that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were up to something. But if you look back and read at them now, there was nothing specific. So I think a lot of it was they didn't have their handle on it, and people just didn't take it seriously.
Tom McMillan is author of a book called Flight 93, The Story, The Aftermath, and the Legacy of American Courage on 9/11. It is just out, 2 years in the making, and some dozen or so years, 13 years now since 9/11. Tom McMillan is the Vice President of Communications for the Pittsburgh Penguins, joining us in Studio A. Tom, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Paul, my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
More Central Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.